now in session. The Honorable Judge Brian, Judge Jessen, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding.
Thank you very much. You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to an in-person argument. We are very excited. I want to say a couple of things before we begin. I hope you can hear me through the mask, but if you're having any difficulties, just let me know and I can try and ask a question in a way that you're able to understand. And we'll be following our normal procedure and our rules today, and I'd like the marshal to go ahead and call the first case.
The first case is case A211037, Credo Salon and Spa, Inc., Appellant versus Liberty Village 1, LLC, et al., respondents.
Good morning. Why don't you state your name and the party you represent before you begin?
Thank you, Your Honors. Christopher Olson, O-L-S-O-N, on behalf of the appellant, Credo Salon and Spa. Your Honors, this case centers around a dispute between a tenant, its landlord, and the HOA. The case is grounded in violations of a provision of the lease that the tenant specifically negotiated with the landlord that prevented the landlord from renting other space in its building to other tenants that engaged in the care of hair, nails, or facials. It's also about a provision of the declaration of the HOA that provided that the second floor of the building could only be used exclusively for office purposes. Here's how it played out. The appellant entered into a lease with the landlord in March of 2012 to rent the space. The lease contained that restrictive covenant that I just mentioned. Credo moved into the space. They built it out as a salon and spa. This is in Stillwater, Minnesota. They built a mezzanine to the space that they had part of their space, and they started operations and got their salon up and running. A few years later, in 2015, they were contacted by their landlord, who informed them that there was another tenant that was going to be coming into the building. They didn't know much about this new tenant, but the landlord told them a little bit about the tenant. The landlord told them that it was going to be a medical spa that treated primarily patients that got referred to it from a hospital. The landlord provided a little bit of information about the type of procedures that were going to be done, and this was in an aim to assuage any fears of Credo, my client, as to the type of procedures being a potential violation of that restrictive covenant. In my client's view, and as testified to by my clients in their depositions, the information provided by the landlord was not complete, was inaccurate, and in fact contained some misrepresentations and omissions in order to induce them to go along with it.
Mr. Olson, I know our time is limited, and so I would like to ask a couple of questions, starting with the issue of damages. Am I correct that in each of the counts, I'm looking at the complaint, pages 21 through 23, and there is a request for relief as to each count. Am I correct that it looks to me that each count for damages has the same language, money judgment in excess of $50,000, and that's repeated for each and every count. Is that right?
That is, Your Honor.
Okay. So what is it? Let's start with the discovery issue. In other words, the parties agreed to a discovery deadline. What was the obligation on the parties, or on the plaintiff, let's say, to provide information regarding damages beyond we'll prove it at trial?
Sure. Your Honor, I'm glad you asked about that, because that's what this case is about, is really about to me, is the issue of the damages. And the damages here were disclosed to the respondents at three different times. First, in discovery, there was a document production. Financials of the company, meaning Credo, were disclosed to the respondents. The financials showed a decline in revenue since InnerSwan, this competing business, went in. At the prior to the summary judgment hearing, as laid out in our brief, 14 days beforehand in compliance with Rule 115, they were attached to an affidavit. Those financials were attached to an affidavit of Nathan Wendler.
I believe
that's index number 50.
Jump in because I want to make sure I have the timeline right. Discovery deadline, I think, was November 20?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure on the exact deadline. I can tell you that the disclosure of those documents was made in conformity with the discovery deadline.
You said it was 15 days prior to the summary judgment hearing.
We're talking about two different items. First, the documents were disclosed in discovery. Then those documents were appended to the affidavit of Nathan Wendler 14 days prior to the summary judgment motion. That's index number 50, contains those financials.
Okay, sorry about that. Thank you for clarifying that.
And so, Your Honor, you asked about, well, when was it disclosed in discovery? And that, I think that's a problem actually with the court's order. The court tended to focus a lot on the issue of, well, what was disclosed in discovery? And didn't focus so much on what was put in the record at the summary judgment record. If there were issues about discovery, that should have been brought before the court on a motion to compel or other discovery type of motion. We had in the record at summary judgment financials that showed a decline in revenue. My client, who, as we argued at summary judgment to the district court, was entitled to go to the jury based on the decline in revenue and argue to the jury that decline in revenue was as a result of Inner Swan being in the building.
So if I may, counsel, I mean, because to me, I think you've hit the critical issue on the head. It's kind of is documentation of declining revenue, which, as you pointed out, produced in discovery, is that sufficient to proof of damages to get past summary judgment? I mean, that's the way I see the FIG issue. Is that fair?
I agree.
So what about the Rule 26 that talks about computation of each category of damages? You know, is just, I mean, producing the declining revenue, does that meet the requirement that you got to be computing damages under the rule?
Yeah, no, I think that is a good question to ask. And here's the situation that my client was in at the time. It has the decline in revenue. It had hired an expert witness to computate the damages and provide them. It's not it's frankly associating and connecting the decline in revenue is not something that my client as a layperson was in a place to do. That's why we hired the expert witness, Your Honor. We hired an expert witness that we asked the court for a continuance of the summary judgment hearing in order to put that expert report in the record. The court declined to do that. After the summary judgment hearing was argued, we attempted to ask the court to reopen the record to take a look at that expert report. The court declined to do that. And there's some writing in the briefing about there was a snafu by my office, and the first time we filed that, forgot to check the e-file box to serve Mr. Pierce's office with that. That's referred to as an ex parte filing. Forgot to serve Mr. Pierce's office on that. It was kicked out of the record. We put it back in. We asked the court to consider it. The court didn't. That was an error. And can I tell you why this issue of the expert report and the damages that were put in the record, they worked together to become a huge error. And here's why. We were operating under a kind of a strange scheduling order here because of COVID-19. The scheduling order said that we're not going to give you a trial date until COVID is over. And so we're waiting for a trial date. Meanwhile, we're engaging in discovery. We're going through the discovery process. As the litigant, you have to make considerations as the litigant's counsel of when you're going to do things, when you're going to spend money for experts, those kind of things. We didn't have a deadline for an expert in the scheduling order. So we default to 90 days before trial. We get a motion brought by Mr. Pierce for summary judgment. At that point, in their briefings, they're arguing that we should have to have essentially expert testimony as to the damages. We go up and get.
They're asking for that computation.
Yeah, that's another way of putting it. That's another way of putting it.
Did you make any motion under 56.04?
Under 56.04 for a continuance?
Well, when facts are unavailable to the non-moving party, you can ask for a continuance, deferring consideration of the motion, but you'd have to present reasons why you're not able to get those facts that would be essential to respond to the motion for summary judgment. And it kind of sounds like if you're saying we had an expert, we were waiting to get the computation that would be essential to respond to the summary judgment motion, that this is a perfect rule for that situation.
We did ask for a continuance under 5604. If you look in our brief responding to their motion, we asked for the continuance. On the record, at the motion hearing, I indicated if the court was considering granting summary judgment on that basis, that we should be given a continuance to have our expert report come in and put that in the record.
So what were the specified reasons that you made in your motion under 56.04?
The specified reasons
were... Maybe you could be more specific. Where can I find that in the record, the specified reasons for the motion?
In our response to the motion for summary judgment, we talk about the fact that the specific reason is that we need an expert to compute the connection of the decline in revenue to the damages, Judge Bryan. On the record, I'm sorry.
It's in the response to the motion for summary judgment.
It is. I know for a fact that in the record at the hearing, I also requested a continuance. I suggested that the court should continue the motion if it was considering granting it based on the damages issue. But as I pointed out, we were in a position where we hadn't been provided a deadline for an expert. Trial was in some time far, far, far away to be set later. We had provided the decline in the revenue to the numbers, to the defendants in the case, the respondents here on appeal. Here's what the law is, Judge Bryan, is that when you are facing summary judgment, you have to make some showing as to damages. You don't have to put in the same showing all the same evidence that you're gonna put in at trial. But you have to put in some showing that would allow the court to say, you know what, it does look like they have some damages here. You can do that, as we cite in our brief, you can even do that with some circumstantial evidence. We did that. The financials that we put in opposing that summary judgment, the affidavit that we put in, that in and of itself is enough to establish that there were damages that were incurred in the form of declining revenue. And we should have been allowed to, my client should have been allowed to argue that to the jury.
So, Mr. Olson, if I may, what about the issue of causation of the damages? You've talked about kind of were you relying on the expert to have the testimony of causation? I mean, didn't you need to have the, you know, evidence of causation to get past summary judgment?
Well, the evidence of causation, there are some cases that talk about causation. But the evidence of causation is inferred by the circumstantial evidence of the decline in revenue from the time that InterSwan came in. For the purposes of summary judgment, reading the record in the light most favorable to my client, which is what the district court was supposed to do, that's enough to avoid summary judgment, Your Honor. And we're talking about this issue of damages. I think it is the most important issue for the Court of Appeals to consider here. I'm happy to talk about the other issues of latches, and unclean hands, but to me, the law on those are real clear. The district court made a huge error in basing its decision on almost primarily as the primary reasoning of latches. And latches just doesn't apply here. It's a claim that was brought within the statute of limitations, first of all. We cite some cases in our brief that says that if that's the case, it's brought, and it's a statutory, I mean, it's a contractual claim brought within the statute of limitations, latches doesn't apply. Moreover, there's no evidence in the record at summary judgment of any prejudice to the respondent. As to the issue of unclean hands, it was unclear to me in reading the district court's order to what counts and to what extent the analysis of unclean hands applied. But frankly, the record doesn't support it for a single count. The unclean hands analysis is almost exclusively grounded in the idea that my client is bringing a cause of action claiming that there's a violation of the HOA declaration on the second floor. But at the same time, in the court's view, that there was some evidence about Credo doing things themselves on the second floor. First of all, unclean hands doesn't apply to contractual claims. It applies to certain injunctive or equitable claims. and the court seemed to apply it to all sorts of counts that weren't there. Moreover, there's a fact issue at summary judgment as to that use of the second floor. My client testified, and it's in the record at the deposition of Nathan Wendler, that the use of the second floor was not a second floor. It was a custom-built mezzanine accessed through the salon. Regardless, on that issue, there was no counterclaim filed by the defense in the case. There was nothing put in front of the court to allow it to make a decision on that basis. The single citation in the order, I believe, was to the simple sight of, you know, those who ask for equity have to do equity. I agree, those who ask for equity have to do equity, but that didn't apply here in this case, Your Honors. What we had was a provision in the declaration that said that the second floor could only be used exclusively for office purposes. It was being used for things other than office purposes. They had to go to trial to be determined by the jury. So, Your Honors, I'd ask that the court reverse and remand the district court's decision on this for the reasons laid out in my argument and in my brief.
May I proceed?
You may.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jack Pierce. I represent the respondents. The issue that is dispositive of this motion is the issue of damages. And a lot of talk has been made about declining revenue. Declining revenue has no impact whatsoever on the issue of damages, because declining revenue is not an element of damages. Rather, what a litigant must show is evidence of lost profits. It's not revenue, it's lost profits. Moreover, it's not just lost profits, it's lost profits that must be caused by the other party. And what is being missed here, I think, is the appellant is trying to make this a little bit more complex than it need be. You don't need an expert to show evidence of damages in a case such as this. It is relatively simple. And you do it by this. Bob and Janet were once customers of the appellant. Bob and Janet used one of the respondent services. Had Bob and Janet used appellant versus the respondent, they would have made X dollars in profit. There's damages. That's how you show damages. The B&Y case from the Supreme Court in 1979 pretty much lays that out relatively clear. This is how you show damages. You don't need an expert to do so. And in fact, even though the expert report was stricken from the record, if the court were even to look at it, it's basically math. What the expert report says is, here's a mathematical formula, here's how you plug in the revenue numbers, and here's the decline in revenue. I can do the mathematical exercise, you give me the formula, I can put in the numbers. What is missing is causation. What did any of my clients do to cause the appellant damages, no matter how defined? What did my clients do to cause a decline in revenue? In 2020, COVID was an issue. It caused decline in revenues for everyone. Is the decline in revenue in 2020 related to COVID or related to my client? That's not my obligation to show. That is the appellant's obligation to show. And to clear up the record just a little bit, because I think appellant's counsel misspoke. At the summary judgment hearing, there was never a request under Rule 5604. Rule 5604 requires, by its terms, an affidavit. That, in essence, what you do is you submit an affidavit that says, A, I need additional time to do discovery. B, here's why I didn't do it before. C, here's what I'm anticipating the discovery to show. D, this is how long it will take. Please, can I have more time? And the 5604 specifically references an affidavit. Now, the affidavit that was submitted in response to the motion for summary judgment was an affidavit by Mr. Frank. It's at Appellate Doc 35. All it says, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but what it references, here's an exhibit, this is what it is. Here's an exhibit, this is what it is. It does not reference Rule 5604 at all. Indeed, if you look at appellant's brief, just look at the citation, the table of authorities. It cites to Rule 5605, where you can ask for a continuance. It does not cite to Rule 5604.
So let me make sure I'm clear. You're saying that there's no reference to 56.04 in either the oral statements at the hearing or in the responses to the summary judgment motion. There's no actual motion that says 56.04, we move under this rule. I didn't see that, but in in terms of what was filed, the written response, and then in the hearing itself, was there any mention of 56.04?
For certain, in the written submissions, there was no reference to Rule 5604. I don't recall there being a reference to 5604 at the argument, but I can say there was no argument that was said complying with Rule 5604. I haven't been had time to do it for this reason. This is what I'm going to show. This is how much time I need. That was not argued. And in fact, the argument was, not that I don't need more, I need any more time, the argument is I don't have to. The argument was, as it was on the briefing here, the consistent argument has been a litigant does not have to show evidence of damages at any point in time until 90 days before trial. That is clearly not the law. The rules of civil procedure state as such. 2602 is sort of the fail-safe. And what that provides is, in the event a litigant, for whatever reason, decides, I'm not going to ask an interrogatory on experts, you still have to give it to them 90 days beforehand. That's the fail-safe. 2602B and E, though, say, 2602B is, here's the things that you can discover. 2602E says, as it relates to experts, you can ask interrogatories that say, who's the name of your expert? What's the substance of the facts and the opinions? What are those based on? So you are allowed to obtain discovery on those topics. Appellant's argument is, no, you're not. I don't have to give you that. The only time I have to give you that is 90 days before trial. And even if I don't, you can't get summary judgment. Two responses to that. One, the rule doesn't say that. We asked in an answer to interrogatories, give us your expert information. And it was the same response. You can't ask me that. That's in the province of the fact finder. Two, you don't need an expert to show damages here. And in fact, I don't even know how an expert would opine on what math is. Math is math. There's no need for an expert opinion. Three, there are a number of cases. In fact, the BNY case is very illustrative to the case here. In that case, BNY, it was based on a violation of a non-compete. And summary judgment was granted on the issue of damages. And what the Supreme Court did is it reversed on one issue. And that issue was the plaintiff there had shown that Ball, who was the defendant, had done work for a client of BNY, and Mr. Ball admitted that, yeah, that was a customer of BNY. There was the causation. All of the other elements that they tried to show, declining revenue, Supreme Court said, no, you have to show declining profit, and it has to be caused by the defendant. And in BNY, at the summary judgment stage, there was an actual computation of the declining in revenue from year to year to year. Here's a number of clients that we lost. But there was no evidence at summary judgment as to causation. Appellant here missed on two points. One, there's no evidence of damages. Even if the court were to concede, yes, we know what declining revenues are, that's not an element of damages recognized by this court or the Supreme Court. It's lost profits. Two, where's the causation? That is what is missing. What did any of my clients do that caused a decline in revenue, let alone a decline in profit? It's not in the record. And I would invite the appellant to point out to the court where in the record it shows that any of my clients did anything or failed to do something that is causally connected to the damages that they are claiming. So because I don't want to take any more of the court's time, I'm just going to rest when it comes to the latches argument and what's contained in my, unless the court has questions of me. This case is all about damages. At the hearing, the only evidence of anything was, here's what our revenues are. The expert report, as faulty as it is, was not part of the record. There wasn't a request pursuant to Rule 5604, let alone one that was granted, keeping in mind that you can make a request under Rule 5604, and you hope and pray that the district court will grant your request and postpone things. It's not absolute, because one of the things the district court will look at is, have you been diligent? What have you been doing? Why do you need additional time? Has somebody been ill? Has somebody been out of the country? Is there a reason you can't? Counsel made the mention that somehow it was the respondent's obligation to bring a motion to compel. No, it's not. From a strategic standpoint, if a party tells you, I'm not going to give you evidence of damages, The last thing I'm going to do is say, please, 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 and ask the district court to give it to me. You fall on your own petard there. You go to summary judgment. You don't have evidence of damage that you've disclosed to me. Summary judgment is appropriate. It's exactly what the district court found here. And unless the court has any questions for me, I thank you for his time.
Well, I would like to, before you sit down.
Sure.
Let's assume that we agree with the appellant in this case regarding damages, and now we're looking at the other reasons why summary judgment might have been granted. Specifically, in terms of an equitable remedy of, let's say, laches, that when you have a statute that provides for a statute of limitations, period, is it both have to be met? I mean, is it simply just the statute of limitations period that applies to a contract claim that we would look to determine whether or not that claim is timely?
The answer to the question is yes, and here's why the answer is yes. It depends on the relief that you are seeking. For laches applies to equitable claims. It doesn't apply to strictly legal claims. So here, as Your Honor mentioned to Mr. Olson earlier, each of the counts of the complaint, seeks money damages. In the addendum clause, there is a request for injunctive relief. So the laches would apply to the injunctive relief claim.
Not the statute of limitations. So you're arguing that the statute of limitations for a breach of contract claim does not apply to a remedy seeking injunctive relief for a breach of contract.
It would apply if you sought that in excess of 6 years. The laches is not dependent upon that 6-year time frame. A laches claim is viable within the statute of limitations. That's why Rule 8 has both as affirmative defenses. They're not subsumed into one. The court has held previously that depending upon the nature of the relief you are seeking, if you are seeking monetary relief, a strictly legal right, if you are seeking monetary relief, laches and statute of limitations are one and the same. In a contract claim, it's 6 years. So laches is not independent of statute of limitations. In fact, laches wouldn't apply because the statute of limitations is what it is. If, however, you're seeking equitable relief, then laches applies. And it makes sense, because one of the things that is required to get equitable relief is a showing of irreparable harm. If you're going to be irreparably harmed, you're not going to wait 5 years to do something about it. Sort of is counterintuitive to irreparable if you wait that period of time. So laches says if you sit on your hands for an extended period of time, doesn't have to be within the statute of limitations, but if you sit on your hands for an extended period of time, you can, in essence, legally waive the right to that claim by laches. And here, what happened was a couple of issues. At the very beginning in 2015, the appellant hired a lawyer. And there was negotiations going back, and then the issue went away. Then there was a conciliation court case. I believe it was 2017. I apologize if I get the date wrong. And in that conciliation court case, Mr. Wendler files an affidavit, because it was my client who Liberty that commenced the conciliation court. And in that case, Mr. Wendler files an affidavit saying, I'm bringing a lawsuit. It's going to be in excess of the conciliation court's jurisdiction, so please strike this. And the issues or the claims that are referenced in that affidavit are nearly identical to the claims raised here. That was in 2017. Another 2 or 3 years goes by, and then the lawsuit starts. So that is the reason why laches applies to the claims for injunctive relief. It does not apply, by definition, to the claim solely seeking monetary relief, which appellant has an issue when it comes to damages.
Thank you very much. Mr. Olson, rebuttal?
On the issue of damages, we cite in our reply brief at page 2 the Jensen versus Duluth Area YMCA case. And what that case says, Your Honors, is that the non-moving party at summary judgment is not required to produce evidence supporting a specific amount of damages. Instead, the non-moving party is only required to show a reasonable basis for approximating loss. That's what we did here.
Well, is there more than one reason that revenues might decline?
Sure. Yeah, there is more than one reason. And that's what you argue to the trier of fact, are those issues of They might point out, well, it's actually due to COVID. We would argue, no, it's actually because the defendant's in there competing with our business. Those are issues for the trier of fact. That's what the district court deprived my client of the right to do when it granted this overbroad grant of summary judgment. And so you don't have to go into summary judgment like you're prepped up for trial with all of your witnesses and your specific evidence of the exact amount. What the case law says is you have to show a reasonable basis for approximating loss. And it goes on to say that you can provide not just direct evidence, but indirect or circumstantial evidence of that. That's what we should have been able to argue to the trier of fact, and that's what the district court deprived my client of the ability to do. On this 56.04 issue that Judge Brian asked about, when Judge Brian, you asked about 56.04, I thought you were referencing the rule generally about continuances of summary judgment motions. To make it clear, my client asked, through myself, for a continuance of the summary judgment motion. We did not file a separate motion.
What was the stated basis for that motion?
The stated basis for the continuance.
And where can I find it?
In the response to the summary judgment, we asked for a continuance, Your Honor, in the memorandum. On the record, we asked for a continuance. Where can you find it?
I'm looking at pages 22 and 23 on the response to the summary judgment. That's where you talk about damages. But the argument there is that the evidence is sufficient, not that you need more time and you're asking for a continuance.
Your Honor, I can tell you for with certainty that at the hearing on summary judgment that a continuance was requested with relation to the summary judgment. It wasn't specifically captioned a 56.04 motion to directly answer the question you asked me earlier. On the issue of causation, which was brought up by Mr. Pierce, causation can be inferred. The trier of fact can determine causation. Causation is not an issue that's determined at summary judgment. If there is potential evidence that is offered in the summary judgment record that a trier of fact could, and when viewing the evidence most favorably to my client, view as causing the damages, that's enough to avoid summary judgment. That's what we have here. That's why this court should reverse and remand the lower court's decision granting summary judgment. Your Honor, that's all I have unless you have any more questions for me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll speak for the other two members of the panel. We are grateful for your arguments this morning, and not just because they were in person, but because of how well the two of you argued the case. We are also appreciative of your written submission.